This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, the part of the show which we like to affectionately call the Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. We affectionately call it that because we try to give you a big picture as to what is actually going on rather than a lot of data points. We're all awash in data points nowadays. And what we need is an understanding of what these actually all mean. Well, you know, there was this little financial crisis back in 2008. You remember that? I don't know. It's way back in the dawn of history, it seems like, after being out of the stock market for 8 years. Look at that. Individual investors are finally coming back. Inflows into stock funds are rising again as individuals pour billions into index funds, whereas 5 years ago, they were huddled in fear on the sidelines. Long gone are the memories of bank and investment firm failures like Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Merrill Lynch, AIG. All the investors here now are the new records that the stock market seems to be reaching, and no one seems to be looking at risk. Where have we seen this before? You know, and this is really concerning because we're in the midst of another Fed rate raising cycle, which usually is the harbinger of another downturn in the not too distant future. Most investors think things are just A-OK, which is what it appears on the surface when you near an investment top. We've talked about this a lot on the program. It's almost the barometer of saying, whoops, we're at the top and the roller coaster is going to go over the other way. Nobody sees the day when the barometer starts to drop. They're having a hard time doing that because right now, just like a hurricane, the storm is far from shore and the skies are sunny and clear and blue and it's nice and warm. So today, for the benefit of our listeners, we're going to focus on the warnings that we see because the elements of risk are building, and we're following a very familiar pattern here.
You know what? It always amazes me, John, being in this business for several decades, is every bull and bear market, or each one of them, are a little bit different. And every bull market favors a particular investment theme or a particular industry, sectors, or asset classes. I mean, if you think back to the late bull market of the 20th century, the 90s, it was all about technology. It was about the internet. We were entering a new business cycle, and things got kind of crazy. So it was technology stocks. If you take a look at the bull market in the last decade, it was about hard assets. It was things like real estate prices going up double digits every year. It was commodities like gold, silver, oil. And then, of course, we get a bear market and things change. This bull market, I think, is different than, and for a number of reasons. I see three or four things that are a little bit different here than what we've had happen before. Number one, it's dominated by index investing. We'll get to that later on. It's a topic we've covered here on our program quite extensively. Number two, there is the force of algorithmic trading that goes on in the market today and dominates much of the trading that you see on a daily basis. Number three, and it's unlike anything I have seen in my entire career, which is the focus of today's big picture, is the concentration of financial assets in the hands of just a few key players. And number four, the growth of leverage, because everybody knew about derivatives, about credit default swaps with AIG, all these kind of things, the leverage in real estate that we were seeing, junk mortgages, all those kind of things. And it was told that, well, you know, we've sort of deleveraged. We really haven't. What has changed is actually the amount of debt has actually grown. It's grown at the individual level, it's grown at the corporate level, and it certainly has grown at the government level. I mean, Barack Obama added $10 trillion to the national debt, just like his predecessor George Bush added $5 trillion. So what has changed is asset values have increased. And so think of a balance sheet, and let's say that you have $100 of assets, of which $50 are owed against. In other words, you owe $50 on your $100 of asset. So easiest way to think of this is your home. Let's say you own a home. It's worth $100,000. You owe $50,000 on it. Now, let's say you go out and get a second mortgage on your home. So you add another $10,000 of debt to your $50,000 mortgage. Now you own $60,000 of debt, or you owe. But your house goes from $100,000 in value to, let's say, $125,000 or $130,000 in value. So even though the debt level that you have has gone up by the $10,000 you borrowed for your second mortgage, it doesn't look as bad because the value of your asset went up. The problem happens is when we go into a recession and a bear market, then all of a sudden, the asset values drop like they did in the last bear market. The S&P 500 lost 60%. Well, now, if you were on margin or the value of homes fell 40%, now that increased debt looks more ominous because the asset values have grown. So the growth of, we've seen the growth of leverage, and this is something that you don't hear too much about. Everybody's saying, well, the asset values look good, the debt levels look good. Well, the reason they all look good is because the asset values, I mean, the stock market is up almost 270%. Real estate values have come back to almost where they were before the financial crisis of 2007. So what makes this cycle different and dangerous is something that we've not seen, at least in my career, is human logic in thinking increasingly is being taken out of the equation. I first discovered this, as I shared with you on this program, about 4 months ago when I looked at market valuations at some of these stocks like Amazon, Netflix. I was thinking, this reminds me of so much of what we saw happen in the late 90s. I kept thinking to myself, what portfolio manager in their right mind would be paying over 200 times earnings for Amazon, which has barely been profitable in its history? In fact, most of Amazon's profits, half of it, have come just in the last couple of years. So I started looking at these market valuations, which led me to find out who owned all these companies that were overvalued. And that's when I began discovering that the largest owners of all these stocks were the index funds. And that's why that we began talking about this passive index bubble. And I'm going to read you something from the almost the inventor of the index fund, John Bogle of Vanguard Investments, because he thinks this is almost a bubble. But today, I want to warn you about another risk we are starting to see, something we're going to cover at our investment strategy meeting, which is the concentration of risk through leverage and the concentration of assets in a few handful of financial institutions.
Now, let me give you the mythology here, because the theory is the politicians, Washington, solved this with Dodd-Frank. And we should put this in perspective. Remember, we had Glass-Steagall after what happened in 1929, during the Roosevelt administration. They tried to fix it, promising it would never happen again. Dodd-Frank was supposed to fix this, right?
Well, they did add more regulations, but the problem, you remember during the financial crisis, what did the Fed do and the Fed and the government try to do? They tried to merge the firms that were going under with stronger firms. So you saw J.P. Morgan, for example, take over Bear Stearns with backups from the Fed. You saw J.P. Morgan take over Washington Mutual. Bank of America took over Countrywide and Merrill Lynch. Look anywhere around the globe, and especially here, when it comes to financial asset concentration, in the thing that you walk away with, and I'm going to share in just a moment, is the big got even bigger.
Okay, wait a minute. Give me some examples, though.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at, for example, let's take a look at our banking system. These are the top six banks. I didn't want to get into the other four, but J.P. Morgan, largest bank, I'm going to round these numbers off, $2.6 trillion in assets. Bank of America, number two, $2.25 trillion in assets. Wells Fargo, $2 trillion. Citigroup, $1.8 trillion. Goldman Sachs, $900 billion. Morgan Stanley, $832 billion. Now, the other four banks, U.S. Bancorp, PNC Financial, TD Group, and Capital One, are a small fraction of the top five. So what happened is the banks got bigger. They took over other failed institutions. As I mentioned, you know, J.P. Morgan took over Bear Stearns. They took over Washington Mutual. Countrywide, Merrill Lynch went to Bank of America. So this concentration made these stocks too big to fail, got even bigger. And that's the thing that really is concerning here. And it's not just the banking system. It's the whole financial system itself.
Well, I know, Jim, that derivatives played a major, major role in the last financial crisis. And I've always had the feeling that they're sort of floating out there somewhere over Lake Michigan waiting to come back in again. Because they represent potentially fabulous profits and fabulous losses, depending on which way it goes. So is that situation at all changed, or how has it changed is maybe a better word?
Well, I mean, I guess you could say there's some good news here. I mean, they've come down from where they were in 2008 at the peak. There was $211 trillion in derivatives. However, from 2008 to 2013, actually derivatives went up from $211 trillion to their peak in the year 2013 at $236 trillion. Now, the Comptroller of the Currency puts out a report. The latest one was Q1 of this year. The amount of outstanding derivatives, John, dropped to $177 trillion. So since their peak in 2013, the amount of derivatives outstanding have decreased by 25%. That's the good news. The bad news, and that's, you know, just part of the story, is they are now concentrated over 90% of these derivatives are held by just four firms. The biggest firm, which is the biggest bank in the United States, J.P. Morgan, has $63.5 trillion. Citicorp has $45.5 trillion. Goldman Sachs has $32 trillion. And Bank of America has $23.4 trillion. So if you look at the system, over 93% of all derivatives are in the hands of just four banks. And here's the problem. If one of them gets into trouble, they all go down because they're all interconnected. And that's one of the lessons I think the Federal Reserve learned with the advent of Lehman Brothers. When Lehman Brothers went down, it took so many firms with them, because you often hear this thing called netting. And let me give you an example. Let's say I have 100 million long in the market. I think I'm at risk of the market going down, so I hedge by going short 50%. So I reduce my long position in half by going short. Well, that short position is only as good as the people who I bought the shorts from, my puts or however I did it. If the firm that I relied on for insurance is not sound and they go under, as AIG did, which underwrote all those credit default swaps, what good is my hedge? And that's why this nonsense about, well, you can't pay much attention to the notional value because these guys net out a lot of their risk. That risk that they net out is only as good as the people that you're insured with. Here's the problem. If you have 10 players, four here in the U.S. and six more globally in Europe, in Japan, own all the 600 or close to 600 trillion in derivatives, what happens when one or two of those firms go under? In other words, who's backing who? And that's the problem. It's concentrated. In the U.S., it's concentrated in just four banks. Globally, close to 600 trillion is concentrated in 10 banks.
That's a pretty narrow margin there for failure.
Well, that's what the Fed didn't understand when Lehman Brothers went under. When Lehman, who wrote all these credit default swaps, they start going under, then it started bringing down everybody else. Because let's put it this way. If I'm buying insurance to insure risk and I buy it from you, but there's only three or four of you, and one of you gets in trouble, you bought your insurance and hedge. Insurance companies are always buying insurance from other insurance companies because they don't want to bear all the risk of having everything tied up themselves.
Yeah, Lloyd's of Ware. Remember how that one unwound?
Yep. This is just something that they didn't understand in 2008, and I don't think they understand it today, because nobody's talking about this. The concentration of risk, and we're going to show you it's concentrated in banks, it's concentrated in financial institutions, it's concentrated in the financial markets. So everything consolidated got smaller, the big got bigger, and there's fewer players around today for the next financial crisis. So it always gets to the same question. If I want to sell and there's only three or four other people in the room to sell to, and we all have the same idea at the same time, who's going to buy? In other words, who's going to be on the other side of the trade? Who's going to be the sucker that is left holding the bag when you have nobody to buy that bag? And that's the problem that we deal with right now.
One would think that would keep regulators up at night trying to figure out how to ride herd on this. What keeps you up at night, Jim?
The very same thing is this concentration, which is one reason we are being so proactive with the way we manage money, because concentration doesn't stop there. And that's something that we've been doing a lot of research. I began doing this project about 4 or 5 months ago, and the deeper I look into it, the scarier it becomes, because let's move on to another form of concentration with implications for the average investor. Now, if you take a look at the majority of the nation's wealth, not counting real estate or, let's say, privately owned businesses or commodities, the majority of the nation's stocks and bonds are held by just 5 large institutions. So we get back to, once again, the same issue that we have with derivatives. So when it comes time to sell, let's say investors start to panic, they want to get out of the market, who are they going to sell to when they are essentially, they own the market? And the biggest holders of financial assets in this country, BlackRock, has assets of $5.4 trillion that they oversee of clients' money. Vanguard, number 2, $3.4 trillion. Schwab, number 3, $2.5 trillion. Fidelity, number 4, $1.9 trillion. And Capital Research, number 5, $1.7 trillion. So these are the holders of the bulk of the nation's ownership of stocks, bonds, and mutual funds. Now, there's 5 other players, from T. Rowe Price to PIMCO, but they range from $600 billion to $300 billion. They're nowhere near comparison to these big 5. So what's the picture I'm painting here? Think about it. 4 companies, 4 banks control 93% of the nation's derivatives. 5 financial institutions control over 50% of the nation's financial assets. So the question that rises here is, when it comes to sell, they will be selling to each other. I mean, picture these 5 firms, and we'll link this even more as we get to the asset bubble, how this plays out, because I'm trying to connect the dots here of how all this concentration connects together and plays out in the future.
You know, you've mentioned before, as I recall, this bubble that's developing in index funds. How does this play into this risk picture?
It ties it all together, because index funds have seen an incredible growth. I mean, if you go back to, gosh, you'd have to go back to the 70s. It's hard to believe in the 70s. Of course, there weren't as many mutual funds and financial assets as we have today. But index funds have gone from 11 million in 1975 to $4 trillion today. Even Jack Bogle, who founded the world's largest mutual fund company, believes index funds are the latest speculative hot potato being passed around the street. And here's the thing, investors have no clue to the powder keg of risk they are sitting on, and that's what ties in. Once again, 4 players control the derivative market, 5 players control the stock and bond market. And that's where this thing really gets somewhat, I would say, John, a little bit scary. Because once again, who are these people going to sell to when it comes time to sell?
Yeah, when you talk about a powder keg, that's sort of an allegorical description. Why did you explain what you mean?
Well, I want to talk about the founder and really the father of index fund investing is Jack Bogle at Vanguard. And he recently spoke to the CFA Institute, and he said, the fundamental principles established by the first index fund are simple. Buy virtually the entire U.S. stock market and hold it intact forever. Eliminate advisory fees, minimize operating cost and portfolio turnover. These simple principles have won the day. But in 1993, almost 2 decades after the creation of the original index fund, a new form of index fund, originally designed for stock traders and speculators, came into existence. That change and that challenge, little noted in financial history, will be long remembered in the future. This new form of fund, called an exchange-traded fund, or ETF, is treated like a stock on daily exchanges, but these instruments have morphed from being simple index trackers to more complex and arcane bets. For example, HYG, the ETF, tracks a basket of high-yield funds. Simple enough. JNUG, meanwhile, tracks the performance of small mining companies, except it is levered 3 times. That means that JNUG seeks to give investors triple the performance of small mining companies. And anybody that's ever invested in a small mining company knows how volatile they can be. it goes on. Bogle's view, which he made public before, is that these ETFs are merely vehicles that allow speculators to take more and more risk. As Bogle notes in his speech, the triple-levered ETFs allow investors to make bets, which of course are extra great when you're right, extra bad when you're wrong. The turnover in these funds, as Bogle writes, is truly extraordinary and mind-boggling. Through September 2015, shares of the 100 largest ETFs valued at $1.5 trillion were turning over at an annualized rate of $14 trillion, a turnover of almost 900%. By way of comparison, the annualized turnover volume of the 100 largest stocks valued at $12 trillion is running at $15 trillion for the same period, a turnover of a little over 100%. Trading in the 100 largest ETFs thus represents 89% of stock trading, up from 7% 15 years ago. Given these powerful data, it's hardly unfair to describe today's ETFs as a group as a modern way to speculate in the stock market. And this is from the guy that started the largest mutual fund company and was one of the fathers of index investing. And basically, he's saying this is the latest thing that's passed around Wall Street, and that's the powder keg that people don't realize they're in.
So here you have the founder citing the problems with us. What other problems that we're looking at?
Well, the biggest problem, and my technician this week, Kamek, talked about this, humans are no longer making decisions. And this was something that intrigued me that began my search into this area about 4 or 5 months ago when I began to ask myself, who in the heck in their right mind is buying Amazon at 200 times earnings? And that is the loss of investors who study and bet on individual companies is distorting the ability of markets to set the appropriate prices for stocks and bonds. Index funds will not protect investors, John, from this unavoidable market sell-off. Just as people are saying, well, if you're invested in an index fund, you capture 100% of the market's gains. Well, that sword falls two ways. You also capture 100% of the market's losses when that time comes about. If you were in an index fund in the year 2000 to 2002, you lost over 50% of your assets. If you were in index funds in 2008 to 2009, you lost 58% of your assets. So that's the problem. See, right now, it's like anything else. The individual investor, absent of the market last 5 or 6 years, coming back in. He's coming into index funds because it's being sold as a no-brainer. You just sit on the stuff, hold it for long term, and voila, you have these great returns. And the problem is nobody's telling these investors what happens on the downside. Now, if you're 25 years old and you're putting money into the stock market every single 2 weeks with your paycheck, you know, I don't think this is going to impact you that much because you've got another 30, 40 years of your working career to take advantage of falling prices. And if you're putting money in each month, well, you're buying shares at a lower price. And all you care about really 40 years from now is how many shares you own. But it is not as good if you're 50 years old or a little older and getting near retirement. Can you really afford to go through another 50 to 60% decline in stocks if you're getting ready to retire? So a lot of this perspective is, John, if you got 30, 40 years ahead of you and you're young, you're, let's say you're millennial, you're just out of school, starting to work, and you're putting money into a 401k plan every 2 weeks when you get your paycheck, you know, relax, sit back and just, you know, ride it because you can afford to do it. You don't need the money. But somebody that's in their 50s, nearing retirement, where the bulk of their assets are in a 401k program, you know, think of what happens to that 401k program because a lot of these are on automatic pilot. It's another reason why today we're managing 401k plans because a lot of investors have said, you know what, I don't pay much attention to this. And a lot of people got spooked in terms of what happened to their assets between 2008 and 2009.
You know, a number of our technicians here on the show have mentioned the narrowness of the stock rallies, and what's come up frequently here on the show is that it's being driven by these index funds, which drive prices.
This is both, John, a function of indexing and also the topping process. Normally, when you see the markets come close to a top, it's the generals that are leading the index, and that's the deceiving part about it. Right now, almost 50% of the S&P stocks are in a downturn. But the market is hitting records because the top stocks, which are valued the most, is what carries the index to these higher levels. So on the surface, you take a look at, oh, the Dow's at a record level, the S&P is at a new record, or the NASDAQ. Well, that sounds real good on the surface, but below the surface, something else is occurring. And that's what's being driven by these index funds that are driving these indexes higher, even though the vast majority of stocks aren't following.
You know, we did a show on this, what, 3 or 4 months ago. If we could just do a quick review here, it might help about some of the details of this.
Well, let's take three major indexes. The S&P and the NASDAQ are market cap weighting, meaning that the stock that has the largest market value carries the most weight in the index. The Dow, on the other hand, is price weighted, meaning the stock with the highest price carries the greatest weighting in the index. Now, what does that mean? It means, for example, if a money comes into a mutual fund, index fund, or an ETF that mirrors the S&P, what is that S&P index fund manager going to do? He's going to go out and buy stocks and make up all 500 stocks in the S&P, but he's going to buy more of the larger cap stock. So if we take the S&P, and then I'm going to tie together something else that's happening here. If you take a look at the S&P, Apple makes up 2.85% of market weight, meaning that if $100 goes into an S&P fund, close to $3 is going into Apple. Microsoft makes up 2.2%. Exxon makes up 2%. Johnson & Johnson makes up 1.75%. GE, a little over 1.5%. Amazon, 1.5%. Berkshire Hathaway B shares, 1.5%. AT&T, 1.3%. And of course, Wells Fargo, 1.25%. So even though there's 500 stocks, if an index fund takes in 100 million, close to 3 million of the 100 million is going into Apple. Close to 2 million will be going into Microsoft. Likewise, let's go over to the NASDAQ, which is setting records. The concentration gets even higher. Apple represents a weighting of 11.6%, Microsoft 8.4%, Amazon 6.7%, Facebook 5.8%, Google, both Googles, almost 8%, Intel 2.6%, Comcast 2.6, Cisco 2.4, and Amgen 1.9. So you can see that Apple carries a major weighting in both indexes. Microsoft carries a major weighting. Amazon carries a major weighting. Now, if we go to the Dow, which is weighted on price, Boeing carries a weighting of 7.8, Goldman Sachs 7.4, 3M 6.5, United Health 6, Home Depot 5, McDonald's 4.8, here again, Apple 4.7, IBM 4.5, J&J 4, and Caterpillar 3.8. So you can see Apple carries a major weighting in the Dow, a major weighting in the NASDAQ, and a major weighting in the S&P. Likewise with Amazon and Microsoft. So if there is a downturn, and you own a NASDAQ, or you own the Qs, or you own the diamonds, which are the Dow, or you own the spiders, which is the S&P, guess what stocks are going to be sold in proportion to their weighting? These large cap weighted or price weighted stocks. And the more dangerous ones are the ones that are listed and featured in all indexes, because anybody that owns any of these indexes, they're going to be selling Microsoft, they're going to be selling Apple, they're going to be selling Amazon, they are going to be selling Google, they're going to be selling these stocks that have a high weighting in all three major indexes. And that's what you've got to be careful, because as I pointed out there, as you take a look at the market cap weighting of these stocks in the index, it's not only driving valuations, because every time new money comes in, those stocks are bought according to those same percentages. Likewise, when you sell, they're going to be sold in the same percentages. And I can actually see something happening that happened in May of 2010 during the flash crash, where you had algorithmic trading and liquidations take place where the Dow lost 1,000 points in a matter of seconds, and some stocks like Procter & Gamble lost half their value in seconds, and there were actually trades at these lower prices. In other words, the stock price gapped down, and if you are following a chart, you know what I'm talking about, a gap up, where all of a sudden the stock goes way above its normal trading range on the upside. Likewise, it can happen on the downside. And that's what I would expect to see, John, is many of these stocks that are common to all major indexes gap down tremendously. So that's why, as Jack Bogle is talking about at Vanguard, you know, investors are sitting on a powder keg here and they don't even realize it, because with the introduction of ETFs, these things are traded, algorithmic trading, on a daily basis, almost 90% of the trading is occurring with that. Imagine what happens when fear sets in and markets drop like they did in 2008, where, you know, on every Monday that Hank Paulson gave a press conference, the Dow would drop 500 points after his press conference. Imagine the Dow dropping 1,000 points at a time, or the S&P dropping several hundred points at a time, or 500 points at a time. That's something that we could see, because it's all concentrated in financial institutions and it's concentrated in index funds, which own a good percentage and account for almost 90% of the trading on a daily basis.
Well, tell me, if I'm guessing right, I would say probably not a lot of investors, or maybe even their advisors, are aware of this risk. So if this thing begins to unravel, what will it look like when it does?
You know, if you take a look at typical market peaks at the very top, as we were talking about in the first hour, nobody rings a bell. So stocks start to peak. And I use the analogy of picture a tree as we get close to autumn. As we get closer into the fall, you start to see a few leaves fall off. Then as we get into mid-autumn, you start seeing more and more leaves fall off the tree. And all this is occurring, but you're still seeing leafy green on the tree until you get towards the end when there's nothing left on the tree. And that's the way that usually these market tops start. At the market peak, nobody sees it. And all of a sudden, the market goes through a correction. We're down 5-10%. What do typical investors do? They go, oh my goodness, the Dow, let's just use a round number. Let's say I bought a stock at 100, it hit 100 at its peak, and now it's at $90. Oh my goodness, I want to get out, but I'm going to wait for that stock to get back up to 100, then I'll get out. Well, what happens is investors are waiting for the comeback. The problem, the comeback doesn't happen. Instead of a comeback, the market drops further. Instead of the stock going from 90 back to 100, the stock now drops to 85 or 80. Now, all of a sudden, you start to see liquidations. Advisors start to liquidate their holdings. Then, all of a sudden, it gets picked up in the media, and there's bad news. And what does the media do? The media, as we have today, with 24-hour news, it starts to dramatize, and it starts to drive home the fear. It's 24-hour clock coverage. The Dow lost 1,000 points. Is this 1929? Is this 2008? You can just see the media feeding this. As the media feeds this, what happens? Panic sets in, and stocks begin to now plunge almost daily or weekly. And, you know, you got a glimpse of this in the first 6 weeks of 2016, when the Fed had just raised interest rates for the first time in December 2015. They raise interest rates, and for 6 weeks in a row, the market's going down every single week. The outflows out of mutual funds and stock funds was absolutely amazing. So stocks plunge until finally you get to that capitulation phase, when people just finally say, I can't stand it anymore. I'm down 50%. I'm down 58%. And boom, that's the market. And that's when you finally get to the bottom. And so that's typically how these cycles play out. And that's why it'll catch people unaware. When the first correction happens, what will happen psychologically, people do not like to take losses. So the stock that hit 100, they're going to say, you know what, it's at 90, I'm going to wait till it gets back to 100, and then I'll get out. Unfortunately, they don't get out. Instead of coming back, stocks actually head lower. The media starts feeding on this. The cycle, selling begets selling. And what's going to be interesting this time is what's going to happen when five institutions, and almost $4 trillion of index funds control the market, who in the heck are these people going to be selling to?
Okay, well, having said that, where do we stand in this little cycle? Is it time to reach for, Maalox, or is there some other way of dealing with this, shall we say?
Well, I mean, if you are prepared and you are de-risking your portfolio, which is one of the things that you should be doing right now, given the fact that we're in the middle of a Fed rate raising cycle, we're towards the end of a business cycle in terms of age and valuation, you should be doing that. And the good thing is, if you are de-risking, let's say you own short-term bonds, you own cash, and you own gold, you will have the opportunity of a lifetime to buy great companies at great prices. I mean, think back to March of 2009. You could have picked up Coca-Cola between $14, $15 a share. Today, it's over $40. You could have picked up Procter & Gamble between $33 and $34 a share. Today, it's over $90. You could have picked up Exxon at $43. Today, it's over $80. You could have picked up Microsoft at $12 to $13 a share. Today, it's over $70. So the key is to understand this macro environment, the risks that are out there, the consequences of a Fed rate raising cycle, recessions, and bear market history. You need to know your history. You need to know your risk. Nobody, not even us, here on this program can tell you when the market will top. All we can do is warn you. You know what I want to do, John? I want to quote from a recent newsletter from somebody that I respect a lot, Dave Rosenberg at Gluskin Sheff, and he recently wrote this week, "To reiterate, I always come from a perspective of forecasting, strategizing, and investing around themes which I have confidence, and I willingly shy away from themes where the ranges of probabilities or possibilities are far too wide for my liking. I prefer to discuss thematics that I strongly believe transcend politics or geopolitics. My primary theme is very specific, and it relates to where we are in the business cycle and what we should be doing about it." He goes on, "Where are we in the U.S. economic cycle? We are late. How late exactly? Well, I would say very late, or in baseball parlance, I would say the bottom of the eighth inning at the very least, much closer to the seventh inning stretch than we are to the national anthem. This month, we celebrate the 100th anniversary in months of the business expansion, which is about three times as long as the average of the other 30 cycles since the end of the Civil War. Now, that said, given how differently the economy is managed today, with fiscal and monetary interventions, and how the advent of Keynesian and post-Keynesian thoughts have smoothed the cycle since the end of World War II, it probably makes more sense to compare this one to the other 11 cycles in the past seven decades. But even on this basis, this cycle is 50% longer than the norm. Only two other cycles, in fact, have lasted as long as 100 months, 106 months in the 1960s, and 120 months in the 1990s. So if we make it to May of next year, we probably will. This becomes the second longest on record. Now, I'm completely aware that no expansion dies from old age. And this is something we've been telling you folks. No expansion dies from old age alone. There is always a catalyst, and it has always come from a Fed tightening cycle, which we are now in. And Janet Yellen seems to be willing to step it up a notch. Expansions typically end because of acute capacity constraints, which have indeed impaired in several cases. They end after a prolonged period of excesses, a classic late cycle development where euphoric behavior coincides with extremely lax lending terms and covenants for borrowers and PE multiples, a standard deviation or more above historic norms. And what have we been talking about when it comes to market cycles, the business cycle, market valuations, and on top of that, a Fed rate raising cycle? And I would use the analogy of a barometer. Imagine you're sitting on a sunny beach in Florida. You're looking out, the sky's blue, the waves are calm, it's a beautiful sunny day. But out there off the west coast of Africa, a hurricane is forming. It may not reach you for weeks. If it does at all, it may change its path and its direction. It may build up in its severity as it did when it hit Houston. But nonetheless, it's out there, and you know it's out there. And that's what we're trying to tell you today. We know market valuations are stretched. We know that business cycle, we're in the late stage of a business cycle. And we also know that the Fed is raising interest rates. So am I saying this is over? No. But as Dave Rosenberg just mentioned, we're probably in the seventh or eighth inning of the ballgame. And that's what you need to be doing. You need to be doing what we're doing for our clients, and that's de-risking and managing that risk, understanding it, knowing it, following it. And especially if you are 50, if you are 60, and you are getting close to retirement, do you want to get hit by a major hurricane as we did in the markets in 2000 or in 2007?
So, Jim, does this give you nightmares at night?
Well, it's something, John, that I've been thinking about and our firm has been thinking about and doing research over the last 4 or 5 months. It's one of the things we're going to be talking about at our upcoming strategy meeting in San Diego on October 21st, because we're going to get into our timetable and we've developed some models that we're using to follow this more closely. It's just like what people do in the weather business. They follow the track, they follow the force, they follow the direction of the hurricane. And these are the things that we're tracking right now. But I mean, the thing that really hits me about this in this next one, I can count on one hand who owns the largest bank deposits in this country. It's held by just 5 institutions. I can count on one hand who owns the bulk of this nation's derivatives. I can count on one hand who owns the majority of the nation's index funds in stocks and bonds. This is something I have never seen in my entire career at the financial business. And quite honestly, nobody knows how this plays out, nor for the fact that the Fed's balance sheet at $4.5 trillion, they've never shrunk their balance sheet before. Not even the Fed knows how this plays out, just as they were completely ignorant when they allowed Lehman Brothers to go under in 2008. So yes, this is something that keeps me up at night and keeps us all up at night at our firm as we think about how we're going to manage this risk. And we are putting a lot of time and effort in monitoring this and de-risking. And you don't want to miss our investment strategy conference as we lay this out in detail of our timeline, the things that we're following, what will be the clues, because as every bull market is different, this one's different as well. It's different because of passive indexing, where the bubble is. It's different because of financial concentration. Every bear market is different as well. You don't know how this thing plays out, and we won't know until it actually arrives.
And I guess this is going to be one of those film at 11 moments, because we're going to track it all the way through. But I guess this is at this stage of the game is a heads up. We'll be back again shortly with more of the big picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
This is why Yellen at the Fed keeps saying that we have to normalize interest rates. That's a code word for, look, the pension funds are going bust. Okay? She wanted to start raising rates in 14. She had to wait till 15 because everybody is lobbying the Fed saying, oh, please don't raise rates because you're going to hurt us over here in Europe or Southeast Asia or whatever. I mean, I've been in discussions with this. People don't realize the seriousness of what's going on. The Fed has been basically hijacked. So the whole idea of Keynesian economics, et cetera, it's just out the window. How can the Fed manage the domestic economy when it's being lobbied by the IMF, ECB, and everybody else? So please don't raise rates, because if you do that, then we're screwed over here. So domestic policy objectives has been hijacked by international. So, you know, the Fed is talking about this normalization because what we're really facing on the pension crisis is less in the private side. than it is on the public side. If you look at Illinois, I mean, New Jersey, you got California wanting to raise taxes to top up CalPERS because they're behind. You go to Europe, 50% of the municipalities are virtually bankrupt in Germany. Why? Because politicians have all done the same thing. They promise all kinds of things and they don't fund it. They've always assumed that we're a herd of sheep. There's enough of us. Don't worry about it. There's an endless supply. They can always raise taxes. So why should I fund it today?
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Leffler here with you. You know, the financial industry is always gazing into its statistical magic ball, trying to divine what is going to be in the future, forecast for the economy and for the markets. I have to confess, we do this as well here, and following our own LEIs, leading economic indicators, in both the U.S. and on a global scale. You know, every recession since World War II has been preceded by a Federal Reserve rate raising cycle. And every bull market in stocks has been preceded by a recession. So if those two things cascade together, what then do we know? Number one, we know we're in another rate raising cycle. Number two, the stock market is hitting record levels. Three, economic growth, although it's been anemic for the last 8 years, it has indeed picked up. And so the question is, everything looks like it's pretty good out there right now. I mean, you know, like Alfred E. Newman once said in Mad Magazine, I know the nuns, they kept taking the magazines away from us, but they were great to read anyway. But he would always say, what, me, worry? I mean, what could possibly go wrong with this picture? I guess the real question is, when does it come to an unhappy ending and how do you know about it ahead of time?
Right now, the LEIs are in favorable trends and point to a pickup in economic growth. Now, we saw that in Q2 of this year, and we would have probably seen 3% economic growth in Q3. Unfortunately, the hurricanes are going to distort some of the economic numbers as the third quarter ends, but we only see that for maybe the next couple of months, and then we should have a truer reading of the economy as we get into the final month of the year in the early part of next year. So right now, John, these numbers point to an improving economy and probably even higher stock prices, because the economy picks up. What does that mean? That translates into higher corporate earnings. Higher corporate earnings translates into higher stock prices. And of course, we have the possibility of a possible tax cut, which, as we have pointed out in the program, could be the one thing that counteracts what the Fed is doing and extends this economic cycle for a lot longer.
Yeah, but right now, I mean, if we look at it, things are looking pretty good. The economy is growing at the fastest rate it's been doing in the last 8 years. Stock market, well, it's at records. Looks like any storm fronts are further out. So, should we pull out the champagne corks?
Not so quick. You have to remember, at the peak of a business cycle, everything looks good as the economy and the markets begin to peak. The stock market is usually at record levels. Economic growth is high. Inflation is picking up, and this is something we're watching rather closely because typically we have not seen that, but we think we are beginning to see signs that inflation will pick up. But here's the thing. Underneath the surface, things are deteriorating, which go unobserved. I mean, the media is focusing on the good news. It's similar, John, to sort of looking through the rearview mirror, and that's the way it always looks at the top. I mean, think back to December 1999 when the NASDAQ was up 70%, and think of the first quarter of, let's say, the year 2000 when the NASDAQ went up another 20%. We did not know then that by the end of the year, we would be in a recession. The market was at record levels. The economy was growing. We were in a new economy. Fast forward to the years 2006 and 2007. The stock market was going up each year. Real estate prices were rising. Economic growth was rising. But also, we were starting to see signs of inflation. So this is something you always see at the very top. Home prices rising, stock prices, economic growth. Everything always looks rosy at the top before the fall and decline, which is why so many investors fall into the trap and are caught unaware.
Okay, well, here's the big question. How do you know when you're at the top? Because that's what everybody wants to know, you know, as far as timing and when they should be getting out. And then you raised the issue in the first part of the big picture was, if everybody's getting out at the same time, who's going to buy?
Well, you know, something that we do, in addition to our LAIs, we look at something we call anticipatory indicators. It's the view of what is going to happen up at the 40,000 feet level. The LAIs tell you turning points, but for the LAIs to be meaningful, you usually need a trend of 3 to 6 months. Just because a leading indicator changes 1 month, you don't know if it's an anomaly. And especially now where the economic indicators are going to be skewed or distorted somewhat because of the recent hurricanes. So when it comes to LAIs, they are anticipating, but you usually want to see a trend. You don't want to take 1 month and say, aha, this is down, so therefore we're going into a downturn. So to tell us when the ship is beginning to turn, we use something what we call anticipatory indicators, which give you a bigger, larger view of trends when you are most likely can anticipate a turn in the LAIs in advance of these indicators actually changing. So in addition to LAIs, we use large macro trends to peer into the future. One reason, John, right now, we aren't 100% invested in stocks right now.
So if you're talking about looking at this higher level, what are you watching then?
I mean, we're looking at four large macro trends, and they have to deal with the economy itself. We're looking at profit margins and profits at S&P 500 companies, which we believe have peaked. We're also looking at auto sales, which have also peaked. Remember, these are very important indicators of what's going on in the economy. We're also looking at real estate, which is weakening, but will be delayed in this economic cycle. And one reason is usually real estate peaks before a recession. And it comes about because interest rates begin to rise. The Fed is raising interest rates, so mortgage rates begin to rise, and then real estate goes into a downturn. Unfortunately, because we were in a bubble in the last upturn, real estate really didn't begin to turn around to around 2011, 2012. That's when the Fed initiated QE infinity, where they really began to drive down long-term interest rates to the low 2% level. And then we saw those 3% mortgages. It was around the end of 2011 and 2012 that you really began to see the upward turnaround in real estate prices. Real estate prices began rising at the lower levels, then they began moving up into the higher levels. And so real estate, in many ways, is a little bit behind its normal role in anticipating a recession. And that had a lot to do with the real estate bubble in the last economic upturn. The other thing that we're watching is we're watching the relationship of the federal funds to 10-year treasuries. And that is something that's going to tell us what's going to happen in terms of timing. And as we move closer towards that final end date where we think we're going to be entering into a recession and ultimately a bear market in stocks. So these indicators give us sort of a better historical view of when and where we are likely to see a likely peak in the economy in the next recession. And of course, what follows a recession is a bear market. We also have a number of other indicators we use in our model, which are proprietary. But these are some of the things we're looking at I would say, probably the 40,000 foot level, because they're sort of anticipating in the future when we are most likely to see the LAIs begin to change and why we find this valuable. Because once again, and we've seen this in the past, where you have, let's say, key indicators that people watch, like the ISM, the Confidence Board, Fed regional surveys, and you might get a couple of months where a couple of these indicators turn negative, others are positive. So there isn't kind of a clear trend. It just tells you there's a divergence. Well, you don't know that divergence is becoming a trend. And that's where the anticipatory indicators come in, because that's when they start to turn and all point in one direction. Then that gives us more confidence when we begin to see these LAIs turn that things are heading down a certain path.
Well, given this from the 40,000-foot level, then, what are your models telling you about the arrival of a bear market, which we've been discussing, and I guess what the signs would harbinger its arrival?
You know, right now, those models are telling us late Q4 of 2018, probably closer to the end of November, December, or the first quarter of 2019. As I mentioned in the last segment, in our opinion, we're either in the late seventh or the early eighth inning of the ball game, which means we still have room to run here. And once again, as we talked last week on the program, obviously the shape of tax cuts in terms of what they will do to business taxes, business tax rates, and incentives, a lot of that can shape whether it's late Q4 2018 or Q1 in 2019. Because remember, even though tax incentives may help spur the economy, on the other hand, we may see inflation pick up with the Fed getting more aggressive, which it is now doing. This month in October, the Fed is shrinking its balance sheet, something it's never done in the past, and is now beginning and will accelerate that shrinkage, which means it's going to pull money out of the markets. It's withdrawing liquidity, and it's also going to put upward pressure on interest rates, which we're starting to see now.
Okay, well, let's come up with a proposal here. What if you just relied on the LEIs and you stayed fully invested until the LEIs say that you're at the tops?
Well, first of all, we're not that smart. And like, you know, I want to use another weather analogy. Imagine that you're looking out and off the west coast of Africa, you see a storm that's beginning to build in the Atlantic. Well, number one, you don't know the force of that storm. Is it just going to be a storm, a tropical storm, or is it going to be a Category 3, Category 4, Category 5 hurricane, as we saw with some of the recent hurricanes? Another factor that you don't know is what is going to be the path of the storm. So our anticipatory indicators are, I'd like to use the analogy, they're kind of like Doppler radar. They show that out there, there is the building of a storm. The LEIs are like the barometer, and we pay attention to both. So we're using both tools because the anticipatory indicators, once all those fall into place, that gives you the confidence when the LEIs turn or you see them turning, you begin to take actions and certain things that you begin to do from an investment point of view. So it's just one more thing that gives you more confidence of what you're seeing unfold, because there is no one indicator, no magic indicator. And as I talked about LEIs, you really want to see a trend in the LEIs that is a 3-month trend to a 6-month trend to give you more confidence that things are turning.
Okay, well, if we are where you say we are right now, what are you doing?
Well, the anticipatory indicators tell us a change is coming to the markets. And what does that mean? That means sector leadership within the market is going to change. And we're already seeing that to some degree. You've seen that mentioned by several of the technicians that we have on the program. Even though the major indexes are hitting records, it's mainly driven by a handful of the big, large cap stocks. In other words, the generals are leading the charge, but not all the troops are following. So there's fewer stocks rising, and there are more stocks that are moving into downtrends. We're also watching what we see as a pickup in inflation, which tells us commodities may be ready to start a run. We're looking at oil, we're looking at copper and the base metals, and then finally gold. And another thing that I think is very important is we are watching bond yields rising as we expect more rate hikes and the Fed to begin shrinking its balance sheet, which is beginning this month, which is going to hit the bond market with rising rates. And what does that mean? It's going to make it more expensive to borrow, whether you're borrowing to buy a new home, a home mortgage, an auto loan, or credit cards, as we expect real estate market will be the next market to peak. So as of now, our models tell us change is coming and we are altering the composition of our portfolios and we are gradually shifting from offense to defense. And I think that's a very important thing investors should do, because as we point out, usually when you get to the market tops, when you're watching the evening news, folks, or reading the newspaper, all you're going to hear is good news. The economic growth is accelerated. The stock market is at new records. These are all the good things. And remember, as I pointed out earlier, what it was like in the final months of 1999 or the first couple months of 2000. Everybody was giddy with excitement with the stock market records and economic growth. The market peaked in March and we were in recession by the fall of that year. Likewise, in the last financial downturn in 2006, stock prices were rising, real estate prices were rising. Same thing in 2007. But in 2007, the stock market peaked. The bond market peaked already before that, and I think the bond market has peaked. And then, of course, by December of 2007, we were in a recession. But nobody was talking about a recession until the Lehman Brothers and the financial crisis unfolded in the fall of 2008.
Anything else you're watching?
Another one that we're paying close attention, and this is also a confirming indicator, is investor sentiment is the highest it's been. The individual investor, who's been absent the majority of this bull market, is back investing in the next bubble, which is passive index funds, which is another sign you typically see as you approach market tops. The little guy gets back in. And that's something that a lot of the technicians will comment on as well, because we have commented here, the big driver of this bull market has been central bank buying of stocks and corporate buybacks. Corporate buybacks were averaging almost $500 billion a year. And that was a big driver of this equity bull market. The individual investor was mainly going into bond funds and in cash. That changed after Trump got elected, as we saw inflows begin to move into passive index funds, and they're doing so at a scale that we have not seen. And as I mentioned in the last segment, index funds and ETFs now make up almost $4 trillion.
You know, Jim, we have our strategy conference coming up on December 21st. I'm assuming that a lot of what we're talking about here, you will be covering in that conference a lot more in depth.
Yeah, we're going to cover many of the issues that we've been discussing here on the program over the last 4 or 5 months. We're going to talk about the passive index bubble, who owns it, the funds. We're going to talk about the Fed cycle and anticipatory leading indicators. We're going to show them what they're telling us in terms of time frame. We're also going to talk about the transition we see coming to the financial markets, and then also get into defensive and hedging strategies to show you how to protect assets. Not to mention, we're going to also be talking about the implications of these tax laws and what to anticipate in the future. I think this tax bill, as we covered last week extensively on the program, is a Trojan horse to higher tax rates that are coming down the road that are going to impact wealth in so many different ways. And so we're going to cover a lot of this and what you can do about it in much more detail. But a lot of the themes that we've been covering on the program, and I am going to be writing an article soon. I've been gathering information because I've been doing research on many of the topics that we've been talking about in this bubble that we began talking about first on the program going back to May, and I'm going to be laying that out here shortly.
And more information on attending the seminar?
They can go to our website at financialsense.com, or they can call the office at 858 toll-free 486-3939.
But Jim, a lot of people are probably not going to be able to travel to San Diego. Any other way to have access to this information?
You know, one of the things that we've been urged to do, and one of the things we are now considering of coming out, is two new products next year. One is an institutional newsletter, and then another one is the possibility of launching a hedge fund that will have less fees, not be leveraged as many hedge funds are. The problem with a lot of hedge funds is they use leverage in the futures market. They do well, and then all of a sudden you get an economic downturn. They crash, burn, and explode, losing a lot of investor money. So we've been urged to do this. We're looking at this possibility where we can navigate the different markets, from currencies to commodities to stocks, bonds, and various things. But if we do it, we're going to do it different than what most hedge funds do. We're going to do it in a way that is not leveraged and blows up. Because so many times, and you see this, John, we follow hedge funds. They'll have a great month because of leverage. They'll be up 1 month, double digits, and then they give it all back the following month or two. And it's because of the degree of leverage that they use in their funds. So if we're going to do something, we're going to do something different. And it's going to be a lot less expensive because most hedge funds charge you 2%, 20% of the profits. And, you know, that takes a good amount of the return away. So we're going to do it. It'll be less costly without leverage. But those are two things that we're anticipating doing or talking about doing for 2018.
And since looking forward is seemingly what we tend to do most of the time here, for the weeks ahead, what are we watching?
Well, we're in the middle of Q3 earnings season, so that's going to accelerate here as we head further into the month. So we'll be watching that, what corporations are saying, not only on Q3 profits, but what are they telling us about the future? If the economy is accelerating, as some of the LEIs are indicating, you would expect to see more positive statements coming from CEOs. We're going to be watching that. We're also paying close attention to the bond market now that the Fed has begun its shrinkage of the balance sheet. In addition to the rate hike, right now the markets are anticipating almost an 80% likelihood that the Fed will raise interest rates when it comes to December. So those are some of the things we're going to be watching and getting excited about our upcoming strategy meeting here in San Diego. I think it's going to be one of the best that we put on. And so a lot of things we'll be watching as we head into the end of the year. Not as much, John, on some of these economic indicators. That's why we're relying more on our anticipatory indicators, because I think the weather distorted some of these indicators, and we'll see that reflected in the economic numbers here in the next couple months. So that's why we're not going to give them much credence given the distortions caused by these storms. But we'll be here to talk about it, as we hope you will. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.